Top of Big Hill was spectacular in all directions. 3/4 of the mile to the east, beyond the beach, was the great sweep of the blue-green Atlantic. To the north stood a series of immense sand hills. To the south, a long, fresh pond and dark woods. And to the west, the view of views, with Roanoke Island and Roanoke Sound. The day was clear, the wind just as wished. It was October 19th, and after nearly 4 years of concentrated study and effort by the brothers, it proved a day of days. Wilbur made one man flight after another. How many is unknown. No count was kept. He did record, however, flights of 300 to 400 feet in length, and speeds on landing of nearly 30 miles an hour. Only Wilbur did the flying, but now, in contrast to his customary use of the first-person singular when describing how things were progressing, he switched to the first-person plural, as in the lengthy report he later wrote to Octave Chanute. And although in appearance it was a dangerous practice, we found it perfectly safe and comfortable, except for the flying sand. During his first days at Kitty Hawk, Wilbur had closed a letter to his father, saying it would be no great disappointment to him were he to accomplish practically nothing there. He considered it a pleasure trip, and certainly it was for both brothers, to be off on their own in a setting so entirely different from any they had ever known, and doing what mattered to them above all. They had hoped to learn much of value there, and they had, more even than expected. They felt they had found the way forward. With characteristic understatement, Wilbur summarized by saying they were able to return home without having our pet theories completely knocked in the head by the hard logic of experience and our brains dashed out in the bargain. He said nothing of the fact that for the first time he had experienced the thrill of flying. They packed for home certain they would return. Their machine, having served its purpose, was left behind, and Bill Tate was told the materials were his to use as he wished. From the undamaged portions of the sateen wing covering, Addie Tate was to sew dresses for their 2 daughters. 3. Work at the bicycle shop and the routines of family life at home continued for Wilbur and Orville much as usual over the next 8 months. But nothing so occupied their free time and thoughts as did preparations for a return to Kitty Hawk. Plans for a new glider were underway, their concentration on the problem still to be solved. Writing again to Octave Chanute, Wilbur said the new glider would be built on the same general plan as the previous model, only larger and with improved construction in its details. Exactly what those improvements might entail, he did not say, just as he did not say it would be the largest glider ever built until then. The further difference in its details was that the curve of the wings would be greater, based on measurements calculated by Otto Lilienthal. When Chanute wrote to tell Wilbur he expected to be passing through Dayton sometime soon and would like to stop over, Wilbur said he and Orville welcomed the possibility of his visit, but explained that the bicycle business, being what it was in springtime, occupied their attention 12 to 14 hours a day. However, they were entirely free on Sundays. To have a man of Octave Chanute's standing come to call would be a high tribute. He was not only one of the world's leading authorities on aviation, and on gliders in particular, but enjoyed an international reputation as an engineer, builder of railroads and major bridges, including the Kansas City Bridge, the first span over the Missouri River. He arrived at 7 Hawthorne Street on June 26, a Wednesday, not a Sunday, which seems not to have mattered. Bishop Wright, Wilbur, Orville, and Catherine were all on hand to welcome him as he came onto the front porch and into the house for lunch. At age 70, Chanute was short, stout, and dapper, with a lingering fringe of white hair about the ears, a mustache, and a thin white goatee. He was both kindly in manner and extremely talkative. Catherine and young Carrie Kaler had worked hard on the preparations for the meal, but little notice seems to have been taken of it, so involved were the hosts and their guests with conversation. The range and content of the discussions are not known, except that Chanute had brought a gift for the brothers, a portable French anemometer, by which they could accurately measure the speed of the wind, something of great value they had been unable to do before. Then, a few days after departing Dayton, Chanute wrote to suggest that two men with whom he worked join the brothers when they returned to Kitty Hawk the coming summer. Although the brothers did not necessarily agree with Chanute's philosophy that progress in science was always best served by everyone working openly together, they accepted Chanute's suggestion, if only out of respect. By mid-June, they were far enough along with their new machine to move up their departure date to early July. And, importantly, knowing that in their absence this time, the bicycle shop would be in reliable hands. Charles Charlie Taylor had been born on a farm in Illinois and arrived in Dayton in 1896, still in his 20s, looking for work as a mechanic. Employed first making farm machinery, he soon set up his own machine shop and from time to time helped out with the Wrights, making coaster brakes and other parts for their bicycles. Unlike the bachelor brothers, Charlie was married with two children, and he smoked cigars one after another nearly all day. He also worked quite as hard as they, and with skill rarely to be found. Stopping by the bicycle shop one evening that June, just to gas, as he said, he was asked if he would like to work there full time. "They offered me $18 a week," he later recalled. "That was pretty good money. Besides, I like the Wrights. So far as I can figure out, Will and Orv hired me to worry about their bicycle business so they could concentrate on their flying studies and experiments. And I must have satisfied them, for they didn't hire anyone else for 8 years. Of all those who were to enter the lives of the brothers, few were to prove of such value, and none was to so aggravate Sister Catherine. Wilbur and Orville left Dayton together on their second expedition to Kitty Hawk by train the evening of Sunday, July 7, 1901, and for the next several weeks were to experience conditions that made those they had known during their previous visit seem like mere inconveniences. They arrived at Elizabeth City just after one of the worst hurricanes in memory, with winds recorded at 93 miles an hour. 2 days passed before they were able to sail for Kitty Hawk. After a night at the Tate's, sharing the most uncomfortable bed either had ever endured, they set off for the foot of Killdevil Hills and in an all-day drenching rain began setting up camp, a big part of which at that location required driving a pipe 10 to 12 feet into the ground to serve as a well, there being no source of fresh water within a mile. It was Bill Tate who told them how to get good water and who arranged permission from the owners of the land at Killdevil Hills to establish themselves there. Because the new glider was to be so large, the shed or hangar for it had also to be good-sized. Orville would proudly describe what they built as a grand institution with awnings at both ends, that is, with big doors hinged at the top, which we swing open and prop up. In little time, with pine boards shipped over from Elizabeth City, they built a long, solid shed, 16 by 25 feet and 6 feet in height, that would have been considered by many a substantial accomplishment in itself, and they did it in remarkably little time. Then, just as they were about to start work on the glider, they were hit by a misery of a kind and on a scale they had never experienced or even imagined. Among long-standing summer visitors to Nag's Head, the old wisdom was that the infamous Outer Banks skeeters struck en masse only once every 10 or 12 years. On July 18, it suddenly became clear 1901 was one of those years. As Orville wrote, the mosquitoes appeared in the form of a mighty cloud, almost darkening the sun. It was by far the worst experience of his life, he would tell Catherine. The agonies of typhoid fever were as nothing by comparison. There was no way of escaping the mosquitoes. The sand and grass and trees and hills and everything was fairly covered with them, They chewed us clear through our underwear and socks. Lumps began swelling up all over my body like hen's eggs. We attempted to escape by going to bed, which we did a little after 5 o'clock. We put our cots out under the awnings and wrapped up in our blankets with only our noses protruding from the folds, thus exposing the least possible surface to attack. Until then, the wind had been blowing at 20 miles an hour. Now it dropped off entirely, and the summer heat kept mounting. Our blankets became unbearable. The perspiration would roll off us in torrents. We would partly uncover, and the mosquitoes would swoop down upon us in vast multitudes. We would make a few desperate and vain slaps, and again retire behind our blankets. Misery, misery. Morning brought little relief from the suffering. At first they tried working, but had to give up, so unrelenting was the onslaught. In preparation for the night ahead, they built frames and mosquito nets for their cots, then moved the cots 20 to 30 feet from the tent, and crawled in under the nets and again under their blankets. None of this worked. Such was the torture of the night that followed. Orville vowed that come morning they would head for home. By morning, however, their characteristic resolve returned. The demon mosquitoes had diminished appreciably, and in the days to come grew fewer still. But the torment they had been through would never be forgotten. As it happened, one of the two men Octave Chanute wished to have joined the brothers in their experiments had arrived just as the mosquitoes struck, and so shared in the miseries. He was Edward Huffaker, of Chucky City, Tennessee, a former employee of the Smithsonian Institution, and author of a Smithsonian pamphlet on soaring flight. Now a protege of Chanute, he had brought with him a disassembled glider of his own design built at Chanute's expense. To Wilbur and Orville he seemed at first a welcome addition. The second to join the group, young George Alexander Spratt from Coatesville, Pennsylvania, had little in the way of appropriate background for the work at hand. Chanute had described him as having medical training that could prove valuable in case of an accident, but Spratt had abandoned his medical ambitions after finishing medical school several years before. About all he could offer as a reason for his participation was that flying had been the dream of his life, which was altogether true. He arrived in the last days of the mosquito siege. The hangar workshop at Killdevil Hills was now to provide lodging for four. As the chief cook, Orville arranged a corner kitchen with a gas stove fashioned out of a metal barrel and shelves lined with canned goods, Arm & Hammer baking soda, Chase & Sanborn coffee, Royal Purple hand-packed tomatoes, Gold Dust Green Gage plums. Fresh butter, eggs, bacon, and watermelon had to be carried on foot from Kitty Hawk. Huffaker expressed amazement at the brothers' mechanical facility, but was to prove increasingly irksome to them, lazy and indifferent about such daily necessities as washing dishes. He was also inclined to make use of the personal possessions of the others without bothering to ask permission. As tiresome as anything for the sons of Bishop Wright was to hear Huffaker go on about character building, rather than hard work, being the great aim in life. The more they learned about the glider he had designed and planned to test, but never did, the more they considered it a joke. Spratt, by contrast, helped every way he could and was excellent company. On July 27, with the glider at last ready, the experiments began. The day was clear, the wind at Killdevil Hills about 13 miles an hour. Besides Huffaker and Spratt, Bill Tate and his half-brother Dan were on hand to assist. Wilbur was to do all the gliding. As they made ready for the first launch into the wind, Orville and Spratt positioned themselves at the corners. Expectations were high. But no sooner was the machine up than it nosed straight into the ground only a few yards from where it started. Wilbur, it seemed, had positioned himself too far forward. In a second try, having shifted back a bit, he did no better. Finally, after several more failed attempts, he moved back nearly a foot from where he started and sailed off more than 100 yards. To all present but Wilbur and Orville, this flight seemed a huge success. To the brothers, it was disappointing. The machine had not performed as expected, not in fact as well as the one of the year before. Wilbur had had to use the full power of the rudder to keep from plowing into the ground or rising so high as to lose headway. Something was radically wrong. In a glide later the same day, the machine kept rising higher and higher, till it lost all headway, exactly the fix that had plunged Otto Lilienthal to his death. Responding to a shout from Orville, Wilbur turned the rudder to its full extent, and only then did the glider settle slowly to the ground, maintaining a horizontal position almost perfectly, and landing with no damage or injury. Wilbur went again, and again. Several times, the same experience was repeated, and with the same result. On one glide, the machine even began to drift backward. "The adjustments of the machine are a way off," Orville explained to Catherine. "The curvature or camber of the wings, from the leading edges to the rear, was too great and had to be changed. It was this that concerned them the most. The ideal camber or curve of the wing from its leading to its trailing edge, being that which gave the wing the most lift against the pull of gravity. What was so troubling was that the ratio that they had gone by was exactly what Lilienthal had recommended, about 1 to 12, whereas for their glider of the year before, machine number 1, the brothers had used a ratio of 1 to 22. They stopped gliding for several days to rebuild, flatten, the wings back to a camber close to what it had been in 1900, and with fine results. Photographs were taken of Wilbur soaring through the air exactly as wished. He himself would write, "The machine with its new curvature never failed to respond promptly to even small movements of the rudder. The operator could cause it to almost skim the ground, following the undulations of its surface, or he could cause it to sail out almost on a level with the starting point, and passing high above the foot of the hill, gradually settle down to the ground. Further, he had no trouble landing quite smoothly at speeds of 20 miles an hour or more. Work on the wings had filled the first week of August, during which Octave Chanute arrived on the scene. His protégé Huffaker had only praise for the Wrights. As Wilbur had said earlier in a letter to Bishop Wright, Mr. Huffaker remarked that he would not be surprised to see history made here in the next 6 weeks. Our opinion is not so flattering. He is astonished at our mechanical facility, and as he has attributed his own failures to the lack of this, he thinks the problem solved when these difficulties are overcome. While we expect to find further difficulties of a theoretic nature, which must be met by new mechanical designs. Chanute, too, was greatly impressed by what he saw. He recorded little at the time, however, and apparently had few questions, as different as his own methods had been over the years. For all the time and study he had devoted to the science of gliding, he himself had never physically ventured into the air. The successful test, flown with the reconstructed wings, took place on August 8. The following day, Wilbur was back at the controls and in the air once more. But again there were problems, this time of a different and even more troubling kind. Their wing-warping system, of which the brothers were so proud, was not responding as expected, and they could not understand why. When the left wing dipped low while skimming close to the ground for landing, Wilbur had pulled hard on the elevator to no effect. It was like trying to open a barn door in a strong wind. Then suddenly the glider plunged into the sand, throwing him forward through the elevator and leaving him a bruised eye and nose and painful ribs. Octave Chanute left Kitty Hawk 2 days later, convinced the Wrights had made more progress and with a larger glider than anyone thus far, and urged them to keep on with their work. In the days following, it rained without let-up, and to add to his miseries, Wilbur contracted a cold. George Spratt departed, then Edward Huffaker, but not before helping himself to one of Wilbur's blankets. On August 20, Wilbur and Orville, too, said their goodbyes to the Tates and the others and were on their way home. What they talked about on the train heading back to Ohio was neither recorded at the time or discussed in any detail afterward. Yet it is clear from a few of their later comments that they were as down in spirit about their work as they had ever been, and especially Wilbur. It was not just that their machine had performed so poorly, or that so much still remained to be solved, but that so many of the long-established, supposedly reliable calculations and tables prepared by the likes of Lilienthal, Langley, and Chanute, data the brothers had taken as gospel, had proven to be wrong and could no longer be trusted. Clearly, those esteemed authorities had been guessing, groping in the dark. The accepted tables were, in a word, worthless. According to what Orville was to write years later, Wilbur was at such a low point, he declared that not in 1,000 years would man ever fly. Once home, however, according to Catherine, they talked mainly of how disagreeable Edward Huffaker had been. Chapter 4 Unyielding Resolve. We had to go ahead and discover everything ourselves. Orville Wright. 1. The pall of discouragement disappeared in a matter of days, replaced with a surge of characteristic resolve. They would make a fresh start. Wilbur's gloom on the train was only momentary. As Orville said, he was at work the following day, and it seemed to me was more hopeful and determined than ever. We knew that it would take considerable time and funds to obtain data of our own, Orville later recounted, but there was some spirit that carried us through. The boys were working every night on their scientific investigations, Catherine reported to their father. We don't hear anything but flying machine from morning till night. Not incidental to the sustaining of spirit were the glass plate negatives of the photographs taken at Kitty Hawk, which the brothers developed in a dark room set up in the carriage shed out back. There, Wilbur would write, he and Orville had moments of as thrilling interest as any in the field, when the image begins to appear on the plate, and it is yet an open question whether we have a picture of a flying machine or merely a patch of open sky. At the end of August came an invitation from Octave Chanute for Wilbur to address the Western Society of Engineers in Chicago on the subject of gliding experiments. It was his first request to speak in public, and he was extremely reluctant to accept, feeling the date set, September 18, left too little time to prepare anything of substance. But Catherine nagged him into going. That Wilbur might prove a poor speaker seems never to have entered her thoughts. Only days later, in the first week of September, came the shocking news that President William McKinley had been shot by an insane anarchist named Leon Czolgosz while attending the Pan American Exposition at Buffalo, New York. For days he was at death's door. "McKinley is dying," read the large headline across the front page of the Dayton Free Press on September 13th. The following morning he was dead, and that same day at Buffalo, young Theodore Roosevelt took the oath of office as the 26th President of the United States. William McKinley had been Ohio's own. Born in Ohio, he had served through the Civil War in the 23rd Ohio Volunteer Regiment, married an Ohio girl, served long as an Ohio congressman, and for 2 terms as the governor of Ohio. In Dayton, the day of his death, thousands of people filled the streets downtown. The scene was like nothing in the city's history. Fire bells tolled. The courthouse and other public buildings were quickly and heavily draped in black. The Wright brothers, it appears, kept working as hard as ever at the shop, possibly as a way of coping with the tragedy. For Wilbur, there was the added pressure of preparing his lecture. The morning he boarded the train for Chicago, September 18th, Dayton was still shrouded in black, as McKinley was not to be buried for another 2 days. Orville and Catherine, having decided that Wilbur's wardrobe was insufficient for so important a public debut, he went off, as Catherine recorded, arrayed in Orv's shirt, collars, cuffs, cufflinks, and overcoat. Never had he looked so swell. How he felt was another matter. Octave Chanute had written to inquire whether he would mind if the meeting of the society was designated Ladies' Night. Wilbur had replied it was not for him to decide. "I will already be as badly scared as it is possible for man to be." Asked by Catherine and Orville whether his talk would be scientific or witty, he said, "Pathetic." Arriving in Chicago, he went directly to Chanute's three-story brownstone on Huron Street to dine with Chanute prior to the speech, and was relieved to find his host as cordial as ever, and the kind of man whose top-floor private study was so chock-full of models of flying machines and stuffed birds he could hardly get into it himself. The gathering of some 50 society members and their wives convened at the Monadnock building at 8 o'clock. In his brief introduction, Chanute spoke of the advances made in aerial navigation by two gentlemen from Dayton, Ohio, bold enough to attempt things neither he nor Otto Lilienthal had dared try. The speech Wilbur delivered, modestly titled Some Aeronautical Experiments, would be quoted again and again for years to come. Published first in the Society's journal, it appeared in full or part in the Engineering Magazine, Scientific American, the magazine Flying, and the annual report of the Smithsonian Institution. In the words of a latter-day aeronautics specialist at the Library of Congress, the speech was the book of Genesis of the 20th century Bible of aeronautics. It was authentic Wilbur Wright, straightforward and clear. What was needed above all for success with a flying machine, he said, was the ability to ride with the wind, to balance and steer in the air. To explain how a bird could soar through the air would take much of the evening, he said. Instead, he took a sheet of paper, and holding it parallel to the floor, let it drop. It would not settle steadily down, as a staid, sensible piece of paper ought to do, but it insists on contravening every recognized rule of decorum, turning over and darting hither and thither in the most erratic manner, much after the style of an untrained horse. This was the kind of horse, he said, that men had to learn to manage in order to fly, and there were two ways. One is to get on him and learn by actual practice how each motion and trick may be best met. The other is to sit on a fence and watch the beast a while, and then retire to the house and at leisure figure out the best way of overcoming his jumps and kicks. The latter system is the safest, but the former, on the whole, turns out the larger proportion of good riders. If one were looking for perfect safety, he said, one would do well to sit on the fence and watch the birds. But if you really wish to learn, you must mount a machine and become acquainted with its tricks by actual trial. He praised the work of both Lilienthal and Chanute. Lilienthal not only thought, but acted. He demonstrated the feasibility of actual practice in the air, without which success is impossible. Noting that Lilienthal, over a period of 5 years, had spent no more than 5 hours in actual gliding, he said the wonder was not that he had done so little, but that he had accomplished so much. What if a bicycle rider tried to ride through a crowded city after only 5 hours' practice, spread out in bits of 10 seconds over a period of 5 years? He praised the biplane developed by Chanute as a very great structural advance, and told how, with a few changes, he and Orville had built and tested their own double-deck glider in Outer Banks winds of up to 27 miles per hour. Much that followed in the published version of the speech was highly technical and included mathematical equations and diagrams of wing curvatures. "Do not be afraid of making it too technical," Chanute had urged. How critical Wilbur had been about the unreliable data compiled by Lilienthal and Chanute when addressing the Chicago gathering is unknown, since no stenographic record was made of the actual speech. But in the published version, he pulled back considerably, out of respect for Chanute. Of Lilienthal's tables, he went only so far to say Lilienthal might have been somewhat in error. If Chanute took issue with anything Wilbur said, or was in any way offended, he never let on. In a letter written after he finished proofreading the speech before publication, Chanute called it a devilish good paper, which will be extensively quoted. That Wilbur returned to Dayton from Chicago even more grateful for Chanute's friendship and counsel can be seen in the increased volume of their correspondence. Over the next 3 months until the end of the year, Wilbur would write to Chanute more than 12 times, or once a week on average. Some of the letters ran as long as 7 to 9 pages, and Chanute invariably replied without delay. Meanwhile, an article in the September issue of the popular McClure's magazine, written by Simon Newcomb, a distinguished astronomer and professor at Johns Hopkins University, dismissed the dream of flight as no more than a myth. And were such a machine devised, he asked, what useful purpose could it possibly serve? The first successful flyer will be the handiwork of a watchmaker, and will carry nothing heavier than an insect. With their former trust in the calculations of Lilienthal and Chanute shattered, the brothers set out that autumn of 1901 to crack the code of aeronautics themselves. It was a brave decision, and a crucial turning point. Of primary importance was to find a way to achieve accurate measurements of the lift and drag of a wing surface, and the ingenuity as well as patience they brought to their experiments were like nothing done by anyone until then. For 3 months, working in one of the upstairs rooms at the bicycle shop, they concentrated nearly all of their time on these investigations, and with stunning results. They devised and built a small-scale wind tunnel, a wooden box 6 feet long and 16 inches square, with one end open and a fan mounted at the other end, and this powered, since the shop had no electricity, by an extremely noisy gasoline engine. The box stood on 4 legs, about waist high. Although a wind tunnel had been used by an English experimenter, Francis Herbert Wenham, as early as the 1870s, and by several others since, including Hiram Maxim, their tests were nothing like those of the brothers, who proceeded entirely on their own and in their own way. For testing apparatus inside the box, they used old hacksaw blades, cut to different sizes with tin shears, and hammered into a variety of shapes and thicknesses, some flat, some concave and convex, or square, or oblong, each about 6 inches square and 1/32 of an inch thick. These strung on bicycle spoke wires. Though such apparatus did not look like much, it was to prove of immense value. For nearly 2 months, the brothers tested some 38 wing surfaces, setting the balances, or airfoils, the different shaped hacksaw blades, at angles from 0 to 45 degrees, in winds up to 27 miles per hour. It was a slow, tedious process, but as Orville wrote, those metal models told us how to build. Octave Chanute was astonished by what Wilbur had to report. "It is perfectly marvelous to me how quickly you get results with your testing machine," he wrote. "You are evidently better equipped to test the endless variety of curved surfaces than anybody has ever been." When Wilbur apologized for writing to him at such length, Chanute assured him his letters were always too brief. The work was unlike anything the brothers had ever undertaken, and the most demanding of their time and powers of concentration. They were often at it past midnight, as said later in the Aeronautical Journal of the Aeronautical Society of Great Britain. "Never in the history of the world had men studied the problem with such scientific skill, nor with such undaunted courage." In December came another voice of scientific authority denouncing, as Simon Newcomb had, the dream of flight as a total sham, the article appearing in the greatly respected North American Review, and written by no less than the chief engineer of the United States Navy, Rear Admiral George Melville. A calm survey of certain natural phenomena leads the engineer to pronounce all confident prophecies for future success as wholly unwarranted, if not absurd. Where, even to this hour, are we to look for the germ of the successful flying machine? Where is the preparation today? By late December, their experiments finished, and feeling the pressure of economic necessity, the brothers turned to the production of the next season's bicycles. As Charlie Taylor liked to stress, they had to keep the business going to pay for the experiments. Octave Chanute wrote to say how greatly he regretted their decision. For some time, Chanute had been offering to provide financial help to the brothers, which they greatly appreciated, but were unwilling to accept. Practically all the expense of our aeronautical experiments lies in the time consumed, and we do not wish to increase the temptation to neglect our regular business for it, Wilbur wrote to him. What if some rich man were to provide $10,000 a year? Chanute asked, adding that he happened to know Andrew Carnegie. Would you like for me to write to him? Again Wilbur tactfully declined. Besides, he added, it seemed likely Carnegie was too hard-headed a Scotchman to become interested in such a visionary pursuit as flying. As he and Orville had no need to say, they knew full well the importance of what they had achieved with their laboratory work. They had done it together on their own, paying their own way, as they did everything, and they intended to keep going on their own. Not for another several months, until the spring of 1902, were they able to begin building a new glider based on all they had learned from the wind tunnel tests. For even with the help of Charlie Taylor, production and sales of their bicycles still demanded a great part of their time and attention. Word of what they were up to seems also to have been getting around in some circles, and apparently with their approval, if not at their own instigation. For on January 25, 1902, a short unsigned notice appeared in the Dayton Daily News, stating for the first time in any publication that two local aeronautical experts had demonstrated to an absolute certainty that many of the theories heretofore advanced in flying machine circles may be cast to the four winds. These gentlemen are Wilbur and Orville Wright, cycle dealers and makers, who have experimented with marked success in North Carolina and who at present bid fair to revolutionize the work of experts in making tests of aerial navigation. It would be fitting that Dayton should afford experiments which may lead to a complete solution to aerial navigation. This notice, carefully clipped from the paper by the brothers, or perhaps Catherine, would figure prominently at the beginning of a first scrapbook documenting their efforts. 2. At the same time, the family was facing a highly unpleasant situation involving Bishop Wright that put severe strain on them all, and Wilbur in particular. It was a burden he accepted without complaint, even as it required giving up days, eventually weeks, of his time. The trouble had first taken root some 15 years before, in the 1880s, when two contentious factions within the United Brethren Church struggled for control. The issue was mainly the church's traditional anti-Masonic stance, one side holding firm to that position, the other arguing for acceptance of Freemasonry and its secret ways, as one of the realities of the times, and not, incidentally, as a clear means to increase church membership and revenues. Those in favor of welcoming Masons to church membership were the so-called liberals. Those opposed, the radicals, were led by Milton Wright, never one afraid to speak out for what he believed, who, even then, had called on Wilbur to help write articles and editorials in response to attacks by the opposition. But the liberals prevailed. The bishop lost his fight. His role in the church was reduced to virtually nothing. Undaunted, he continued with his travels as an itinerant preacher, and in 1889, the year of Susan Wright's death, he set about establishing a new church to be known as the Old Constitution Church. Time passed. Then, in 1901, an investigation initiated by Bishop Wright found the official in charge of publications for the Old Constitution Brethren, the Reverend Millard Keeter, had been making use of church money for his personal expenses, to the amount of nearly $7,000. In February 1902, the bishop asked Wilbur to examine the church account books, and from his review, Wilbur concluded the Reverend Keeter had indeed helped himself to church funds to pay for his own insurance premiums, personal clothing, and part of the construction cost of his home. But when the church's board of trustees met to review the charges against Keeter, it was decided, despite the evidence, that any discrepancies had resulted from carelessness, not fraud. "My chief regret," Wilbur wrote to his father, "is that the strain and worry which you have borne for 15 years past shows no sign of being removed. It would seem, however, that the fight only increases in intensity." Wilbur also had no doubt that the fight must go on. The question of whether officials shall rob the church and trustees deceive the church for fear of injuring collections must be settled now for all time. In the long run, nothing can be gained financially by deceit. To cheat the people by lying reports is more dishonest than Keeter's stealing. And so far as church interests are concerned, the penalty will be greater. In mid-March, Wilbur took the train to Huntington, Indiana, for further examination of the publishing house records, and returned home 2 days later to assure his father that Keeter's books and papers were very crooked. With strong encouragement from Wilbur, the bishop decided to do something on his own. He and Wilbur spent a full day preparing an exposé of Keeter's defalcations, as the bishop wrote in his diary, and the day after, Orville finished typewriting the final tract. Without waiting for approval from his church, the bishop accused Keeter of criminal conduct. Keeter was brought to trial, but not convicted. Sentiment within the church began to turn against the bishop for having overplayed his hand. Old friends, he told Catherine, spoke of him behind his back as an egotist. Then in May, Millard Keeter filed formal charges against the bishop, accusing him of libel. Wilbur described the situation as absolutely inconceivable, incomprehensible, and incredible. He had not stopped examining Keeter's books, and was, as he wrote, finding new instances of his stealing every few days. Worn down and filled with worry, his father had trouble sleeping. The charges and countercharges continued on into summer. On August 15, Wilbur issued a tract in defense of his father. "When my father and myself came to examine the charges against the bishop carefully, we at once saw that the whole thing was a mere sham. The charges were so trivial as to be laughable. Although Mr. Keeter and his followers are on general principles opposed to investigations and trials, nevertheless they saw some advantages in instituting a pretended prosecution against Bishop Wright. The institution of even a bogus case would afford opportunity for the wide circulation of reports that Bishop Wright's own character was under a cloud." That day, in a letter to his father, who was back on the road again, Wilbur wrote to assure him things are moving nicely and not to worry. Catherine followed with another letter to tell him Wilbur and Orville were so convinced things would turn out right that they were talking of leaving for Kitty Hawk the following week, and that she thought it past time they got away for a while. "Will is thin and nervous, and so is Orv. They will be all right when they get down to the sand where the salt breezes blow. They think that life at Kitty Hawk cures all ills. By late August, the brothers had reached the final stage in building their new glider, stitching yards of white Bride of the West muslin for the wing covering, which they carried on in the backyard at 7 Hawthorne Street, and so inspiring much talk and speculation in the neighborhood. "Some say the boys just go camping, and they make their own tents," said one neighbor. "Others say they're trying to fly. I don't believe they're that foolish." "Will spins the sewing machine around by the hour," wrote Catherine, "while Orv squats around marking the places to sew." On August 26th, with everything needed for machine number 3 packed and crated for shipment, the brothers departed on their third expedition to Kitty Hawk, leaving it to Catherine and Charlie Taylor to carry on with the bicycle store. She was particularly pleased to see Wilbur off. "It was the best thing in the world for him to go away," Catherine told her father. "He was completely unnerved. When he gets a thing on his mind, he thinks of it continually." She also wanted her father to know she was in the fight with him every bit as much as the brothers. "We'll never stop fighting now, Pop, until we've shown those rascals up." Soon she had more to contend with. Charlie Taylor, as she informed the brothers, was making her too weary for words. The man claimed to know everything about everything. "I despise to be at the mercy of the hired man." Thankfully, the school year had begun. Her classes had resumed, and she was now making an unprecedented $25 a week. Things would indeed turn out right for the bishop in the end. 2 years later, at a church conference in Grand Rapids, Michigan, in 1904, he would be completely exonerated by a 2/3 majority. Writing to a niece a few years later, the bishop said of Millard Keeter, "His former friends have become convinced of his unworthy character, and he's gone to Tennessee as a timberland speculator." In all the continuing worry and frustrations involved in defending the bishop's honor, the countless hours consumed, had brought the family closer together than ever, resolved to be ever wary of those of unworthy character. 3. She would just have to get used to some of Charlie Taylor's peculiarities, Orville told Catherine in his first letter to her since reaching Kitty Hawk, then went on to say the weather there was fine, that he and Wilbur had been assembling the machine and were nearly ready to start testing. He imagined, he said, that by the time she received the letter, she would be back at school teaching again, and he asked her to send the list of her victims. "I'd like to see someone else catch it besides us." By the second week of September, word from Kitty Hawk grew more extensive, as both brothers took time to fill her in with news of the kind she most liked to hear. No more trouble from mosquitoes, and they were sprucing up their quarters at Killdevil Hills with such royal luxuries as white oilcloth on the dining table and burlap upholstery on the dining chairs. Orville's letters, which delighted Catherine especially, refute any idea that he had no gift for writing, and express how much he did not want little sister to feel left out. Most enjoyable to her was a rendition from Orville of an all-out pursuit of an uncommonly resourceful mouse that kept prowling about the kitchen and thereby provided the only excitement of the moment. He met with a rather warm reception the other night when he undertook to promenade on Will's bed, Orville began, and got tossed a good deal in a blanket until finally he escaped. "We found him snugly wrapped up in our carpet this afternoon. We had a merry chase all about the building, inside and out, the large cracks in the floor making it easy for him to get in or out in a hurry when necessary. But as there were two of us, one with a stick and one with a gun, one above and one below the floor, his chances of escape were beginning to look rather shaky. Finally, he nestled up in a corner below the floor to take time to get a breath, when I blazed away at him with the gun. The mark of the bullet is in the corner right back where he stood, Nevertheless, the little beastie turned around and calmly walked away, and I, in my astonishment, just stood there and watched him go. The standard of living at Kitty Hawk had been greatly enhanced. Damage done to the camp by storms in their absence had required immediate attention, but they also sought it considerably more. The kitchen was immensely improved, and they slept now in new, more comfortable beds, rigged up in the rafters. They hammered up battens to seal off the cracks between the boards, the whole length and width of the building. They had sunk a deeper well that produced better water. Best of all, they had devised a bicycle that ran far better over sand than they could have hoped for, so a round trip to Kitty Hawk now took only 1 hour instead of three on foot. Little, if any, of what the brothers did went unnoticed by the local residents, who by now, as John T. Daniels said, had learned to love them, and in no small part because they could do anything they put their hands to. They built their own camp. They took an old carbide can and made a stove of it. They took a bicycle and geared the thing up so they could ride it on the sand. They did their own cooking and washing, and they were good cooks, too. There are other improvements too numerous to mention, and no huffaker and no mosquitoes, Wilbur reported to George Spratt, who was to join them again. This time, too, Orville was keeping far better day-to-day diary records of just how hard they were working. Monday, September 8. Finally began work on machine. Completed frame of upper surface wing ready for ribs. Tuesday, September 9. Worked 8 hours on machine. Fastened ribs to frame and put on cloth. Wednesday, September 10. Worked about 5.5 hours each, tacking and sewing on cloth. Surface complete except part of covering to rear spar. Thursday, September 11. Completed covering of rear spar. Erected poles for testing angles at various velocities of wind. Began work on lower surface in afternoon. Spliced spars and fastened on-end bows, ready for attaching ribs. Friday, September 12. Worked 8 hours each on machine. Put on ribs and cloth. Took upper surface on Big Killdevil Hill a little before noon. Find that much better results are found by walking the machine. Saturday, September 13. Finished lower surface. Monday, September 15. Worked 10 hours each. With each wing or surface measuring 32 by 5 feet this time, and a total wingspan, therefore, of 320 square feet, it was by far the largest glider yet built, and as Wilbur also told George Spratt, an immense improvement over last year's machine. On September 19, they took it to a small hill and began flying it first as a kite and with very satisfactory results. After moving to Killdevil Hills, they made nearly 50 glides in 3 days, including manned flights, but cautiously. Even the longest flights were not much over 200 feet. Orville, too, was now gliding for the first time, and proudly so. Then, only days later, he suddenly lost control and crashed. Luckily, he got out without a bruise or a scratch, but it was a clear reminder of just how dangerous it all was, and how suddenly things could go wrong. My brother, wrote Wilbur to Octave Chanute, after too brief practice with the use of the front rudder, tried to add the use of the wing-twisting, wing-warping arrangement, also, with the result that while he was correcting a slight rise in one wing, he completely forgot to attend to the front rudder, and the machine reared up and rose some 25 feet and sidled off and struck the ground. We hope to have repairs made in a few days. Close to the end of September, Brother Lauren Wright walked into camp for an unexpected visit, and George Spratt appeared soon after. At the same time came a rare lull in the wind, lasting several days. With all tests postponed, Lauren and Spratt went fishing, while Wilbur and Orville kept busy as usual, Wilbur also taking time to write an exuberant letter to his father, to report how extremely well things were going. "We are in splendid health and having a fine time." And yes, they were being very careful. Beyond that, he was proud to report their new machine was a very great improvement over anything anyone has built. "Everything is so much more satisfactory that we now believe that the flying problem is really nearing its solution." The letter was dated October 2. That night, as Orville later told the story, discussion in camp on aeronautical theory went on at such length that he indulged himself in more coffee than usual. Unable to sleep, he lay awake thinking about ways to achieve an even better system of control, when suddenly he had an idea. The rear rudder, instead of being in a fixed position, should be hinged, movable. In the morning at breakfast, he proposed the change, but not before giving Lauren a wink, a signal to watch Wilbur for one of his customary critical responses. Wilbur, as George Spratt once told Octave Chanute, was always ready to oppose an idea expressed by anybody, ready to jump into an argument with both sleeves rolled up. And as Wilbur himself would explain to Spratt, he believed in a good scrap. It brought out new ways of looking at things, helped round off the corners. It was characteristic of all his family, Wilbur said, to be able to see the weak points of anything. This was not always a desirable quality, he added, as it makes us too conservative for successful businessmen and limits our friendships to a very limited circle. This time, however, after a moment when no one spoke, Wilbur declared he liked the idea, then surprised Orville even more. "Why not simplify the pilot's job by connecting control of the rudder with those of the wing warping?" Work began on the change that same day. Rather than a fixed rudder of 2-foot vertical fins, as it had been until now, the glider hereafter would have a single, movable rudder 5 feet high, and the operator, stretched on his stomach, would operate both the rudder and the warping of the wings by means of a new wooden hip cradle. Thus no hands were needed, only movement of the hips, not coincidentally like the use of the hips in maneuvering a bicycle. 2 days later, the camp grew more crowded still. Octave Chanute and another of his associates, Augustus Herring, arrived, making 6 now at meals, and even closer-packed sleeping accommodations aloft in the rafters. Further, they had brought a triplane hang glider of their own design that they wished to test, which consumed far more time and attention than the brothers wished, and proved a total failure. After Herring failed several times to get the cumbersome 3-wing machine off the ground, Wilbur and Orville each gave it a try and did no better. Chanute and Herring stayed a week, but Chanute, for all his disappointment in his own glider, understood the importance of what the brothers had achieved. And on his way back to Chicago, during a stopover in Washington, made a point of calling on Samuel Langley to report what he had seen at Kitty Hawk. As head of the Smithsonian, Langley occupied a spacious office in the institution's turreted castle on the Mall. He and Chanute were close in age, Langley 68, Chanute 72, more than 30 years older than the Wrights. They were two personages of high reputation and accomplishment, and with their white beards looked every bit the savants they were. But where Chanute espoused an open exchange of knowledge and ideas among those involved in the quest for flight, Langley maintained extreme secrecy about his efforts. Every aspect of his heavily financed Smithsonian experiments remained confidential. In sharp contrast to the affable Chanute, Langley, a thorough Boston Brahmin, had what his friends kindly termed a shell of hauteur. Since the launching of his pilotless steam-powered aerodrome in 1896, Langley and his Smithsonian team had been at work on a far larger and again well-financed version of the same machine, except that this would be powered by a gasoline engine and carry a single operator. Almost no one, other than those directly involved, knew anything about it, just as Langley wished. until now, Langley had paid little or no attention to the Wrights and their efforts. But hearing all Chanute had to report, he was suddenly quite interested and wrote